The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.
Welcome to The Tower, a podcast that explores the films that took the rulebook, doused it in gasoline, and lit a match. The Tower tarot card represents chaos and the upheaval of old forms. And here, I will focus on films that did just that for my brilliant guests. The films that changed them forever are films that belong in The Tower. In each episode, I interview visionaries in cinema, from directors to festival programmers, from actors to writers, and we explore their favorite paradigm-shifting films. The fire's burning. Come dance with us in the flames. Today on The Tower, I have Kyle Greenberg. Kyle is a friend of mine, head of marketing and distribution at Utopia, which is one of my favorite distribution companies, and the president of Circle Collective. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, did I miss anything introducing you?
No, you know, I think, I'm a distributor, filmmaker, we've known each other for kind of maybe like 6-ish years or so, maybe longer than that, going back to when I worked at a company called Gunpowder and Sky. And we connected because of one of your short films going to the platform Altar. It's a nice full circle moment to reconnect on kind of a different sort of creative level.
Yeah, and we met at Fantasia 2019, I remember. That was my first time at like a big genre festival, and you were so sweet and so welcoming. And Circle Collective is a great name for a company that you run, because I feel like you collect people and you constantly try to engage really exciting groups of people and filmmakers, and you're a great gateway into the industry, I feel like. So thank you for inviting me into Altar. Yeah, I'm glad we've stayed friends throughout your career as well.
Thank you. Yeah, that's such a kind way of putting things. I guess ultimately what I enjoy doing is championing independent film, and it's a crazy landscape where corporations and studio films tend to kind of dominate so many conversations, and so much conversation around film is about money. And, you know, obviously I work with a couple of businesses, but, you know, really it's how do we kind of channel the passion we had as kids, I guess you could say, for film, and use that as the through line for getting eyes on new films and, you know, cultivating community. So yeah, that's really sweet of you to say, like, collecting of individuals, but really it's just, yeah, trying to, you know, kind of keep building a community where we can kind of support one another and keep kind of growing and figuring it out step by step, because things tend to change every couple of years, it seems, in the independent landscape. Some things stay exactly the same as well, but I think one thing that's a through line for me from being a kid to now is that people want to watch good and original movies, and that's why there's been such an exhaustion with the IP of it all, and, you know, the sequels and threequels, and you know, overabundance of all of these kind of superhero movies. And yeah, I think that's why what, you know, attracts me to a seemingly obscure movie like Bloody Nose Empty Pockets. And yeah, being able to kind of straddle the line between distribution and, you know, now also, you know, getting back into my own creative practice, you know, it's like a really unique kind of lane or, yeah, unique sort of lane that I get to kind of occupy where, you know, I'm constantly learning, whether it's from the filmmakers I'm working with or kind of the special interests or niche subjects within the movies I'm working on. And yeah, I think Bloody Nose Empty Pockets we released at Utopia maybe 5 years ago. And it's one of those films that's really stuck with me ever since I saw it. And, you know, I've been following the work of the Ross brothers for quite some time because I really feel like they are these really exciting and unique filmmakers trying to kind of do exactly what they want to do.
I think that's such a good summation. You know, different people have picked different films throughout the series, but this one is so interesting, especially for you, because I'm sure you had a hand in choosing to take it on as a company as well. So can you, even just kind of segueing into talking about Bloody Nose Empty Pockets, what was your experience when you first saw the film? Was it after you guys had acquired it or was it before?
I first saw it probably right after it premiered in Sundance. And it was a physical premiere in Sundance, but it was around COVID, maybe it was the year that Sundance had just kind of like come back in its like minor post-COVID capacity, or maybe it was actually right before COVID hit in March, actually, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, we saw the film, and for me, you know, like I guess especially in my younger years, maybe too much information, but, you know, I loved a good bar. Definitely loved stuff from like Bukowski when I was younger, you know, a movie like Barfly, you know, remains like one of those kind of like films I always think about and frankly would love to re-release one day if, you know, it ever kind of became available, you know, films like Trees Lounge. You know, I think there's always a really interesting barfly culture. You know, I loved going to pool halls and, you know, bars with kind of pool. When I was in university, I went to the University of Texas at Austin. One of my favorite bars in Austin is called Barfly, which just so happens, hopefully, is still there. Last time I was in town, it was. And I just feel like, you know, there's a way to experience people in the world in unconventional places, you know, whether it's like the tube or the subway, you know, on a bus, you know, a sporting arena, you know, but when you kind of start like getting down to it, you know, it's like, what are these intimate spaces where you actually have more of a potential to kind of connect with people? Like, as you know, I spend a lot of time in London now, and you know, there's the idea of the pub, which stems from the public house. You know, in the US, so many bars and pubs have kind of like transformed into like sports bar culture. You know, obviously this is a generalization, but, you know, so many places I go into when I'm, you know, say like in New York, have like 50 TV screens, and it becomes a place to really just watch sports. And, you know, it also disconnects people because they're all staring at screens. And when we're not at the bar and we're on the street, everybody's staring at screens because of their phones. And when you go into certain pubs or these public houses that are really just meant for congregation and connection, then, you know, it's like, maybe you're having a conversation at the bar with somebody and somebody is kind of unoffensively eavesdropping and, you know, maybe asks you a question based on what they heard, or, you know, maybe you're sitting alone at a bar and you spark up a conversation with somebody, you know, then maybe there's just a bar you frequent, one frequents where, you know, you've met the bartender and, you know, you start to know all the locals. Like I had a few friends in Brooklyn who had those sort of spaces. And, you know, as I was hanging out with them and would go to those spaces, I would kind of get to know some of those locals as well. And yeah, I think, you know, Bloody Nose, like jumping back into that, really struck me because of kind of a universal element, which is like, you know, most people, unless you're sober, I suppose, have had, you know, some of these experiences in bars more than others, you know, and can kind of understand the concept, whether they've been into a sports bar, whether they've been into a you know, classic pub with no TVs. You know, it doesn't, you know, again, like, you know, it's like there's a connectivity that you could be in the US, you could be in London, you could be in France, you know, and there's a bar anywhere you go. You know, like my partner Anna and I always kind of joke about the concept of a pub at the end of the world, you know, especially in today's sort of, you know, in crazy climate, and, you know, and like as apocalypse looms, you know, whatever becomes of the world, you can guarantee there's still going to be a pub.
I feel like maybe the American equivalent of the pub is the dive bar or the local bar. Similar to this bar here. But just to kind of zoom out a little bit, just for people who haven't seen the film, I'm just going to read the log line really quick, just so they kind of understand what the premise of the film is. So on IMDb, Bloody Nose Empty Pockets is listed as documentary drama. And we'll get more into that soon. But the log line is a look at the final moments of a Las Vegas dive bar called the Roaring Twenties. But even that logline is a little bit misleading because this film is so fascinating. Yes, the story takes place at this bar. I feel like I'm watching real people. I am watching real people. But this was not shot in Vegas at all. Parts of the exterior shots were, in fact, in Vegas. But this bar existed in New Orleans.
Correct. Yeah. Which I find, it's what makes the film so special. And, you know, if you do a quick search of Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, especially with like how AI has taken over everything on Google, you could literally just search like Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, like controversy, and you'll get like the AI snapshot of why people do or don't like the film. You know, ideally somebody's actually doing a little bit more research, as I know you have, than that. But yeah, I think there was a lot of kind of not necessarily divisiveness, but, you know, I think some people saw the film and felt duped. Some people saw the film and absolutely fell in love with it. And, you know, again, we can get back into that a bit later. But for me, why this film is so important is because I personally feel it pushes documentary forward. It is a documentary, and I hold to that. You know, I think people who want to push back on calling it a documentary are wrong. And, you know, I've already kind of made my kind of, I guess, slam on corporate culture, but you know, to dig into that further, we live in an age of reality TV. Reality TV has dominated everything, and I'd argue it's dominated the form of documentary. There's no documentary I see these days at a more mainstream level that I would consider to be authentic. It's edited, it has music, it's been color corrected, it's been sound mixed. There is no necessarily pure authenticity to anything we watch. It's all movie making and it's all manipulation. And I think what's really inspiring about this film is it is all real people. None of these are real actors. none of them had any scripted lines. Mm-hmm. And all the emotions are real. There's more authenticity in this film than I'd argue you see in 9 out of 10 documentaries today. Mm-hmm. And I think why that intrigues me is because, yes, it's fake. The bar isn't real. The Roaring Twenties never existed. What Bill and Turner did was recruit all of their favorite barflies from their local New Orleans bars, yeah, and they congregated them into a bar they constructed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through that construction, they found a way to create something again that I'd argue is very real. You know, when somebody's crying in the film, that's real. When somebody takes their top off in the film, that was an authentic decision.
Yeah.
You know, spur of the moment. You know, the music playing at the bar is real. You know, it's what people are listening to kind of any bar. You know, the relationships, you know, like, you know, the sadness, the joy, like, I think all of that only stems out of finding real people. And, you know, the film also, you know, because I went back and I watched it as well in preparation for this. I mean, it's so fascinating because it's a snapshot of America. And, you know, we go back 5 years and this is the onset of kind of the Trump election as well.
Yeah.
You know, so we're looking back in time and seeing really a time capsule kind of in a way before things took the turn they took today, I guess you could say. And obviously those turns are always, it's constantly happening. Things are constantly shifting and moving, you know, but, you know, I think it's a really interesting watch considering where we are now.
And if we haven't spelled it out already, this film was directed by brothers, Bill Ross and Turner Ross. And this is very similar to other films that they've done, too. I've seen Gasoline Rainbow. I'm aware of a film they've been working on. I think what they're doing in this space is really interesting. And it kind of is beyond description in my mind, because it is documentary. I guess some people could call this mumblecore, I guess, but that's not even correct. And the fact that the bar is constructed, I don't know, it feels like they certainly cast this film, but with real people, and it feels like a curated collection and an unleashing of personalities in a space, but all the magic that happens within this bar, this fake bar, is so real. And I mean, we'll get into the characters that are here, the characters, the people, but you know, the film begins this long shot of this man walking through an empty parking lot in the morning. And we kind of see him through a chain link fence as the day is starting. And then we go into this bar, the Roaring Twenties, to meet one of my favorite characters, certainly, Michael, who is this older man. He says he's 58. He claims he looks 72. You know, this man has been through quite a lot. The bar is just now opening on its very last day. The bartender is opening up, you know, and Michael is kind of, he's a self-professed alcoholic, and he goes to the bathroom to kind of start his day shaving. And honestly, just the theater nerd in me, Kyle, was like, he's staring into the mirror as he's shaving in this bar. Clearly, like, he's either homeless or he slept here, but he's reciting Macbeth into the mirror, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day. And like, my heart was just like, oh, I love this guy. Framing it with that at the very beginning, just you kind of understand who this person is. And immediately I was like, this person has been an actor, this human being, this character of Michael. And Michael is this man. He is a professional actor, but he is not acting in this film, which it's such a, he's a conundrum to me. And I look forward to chatting with you about Michael more, because he is one of the most heartbreaking characters in this Barfly kind of film. What are your thoughts about Michael?
Yeah, and in a way, you know, one might argue that he's the star of the film.
Yeah, certainly.
You know, we start with him. He's, you know, probably one of the last people we see. He was a real actor. There's a self-effacing aspect of him that's like very evident, and I think it appears like immediately in, you know, the start of the film, where he kind of says he prides himself, something along the lines of him saying he prides himself in not becoming an alcoholic until after he was a failure.
Yeah,
I think is almost the exact wording.
It is, yeah, I wrote it down. Yeah,
and yeah, I mean like, for one, I mean, this is like a sidestep, but through the lack of script, there's just so many golden lines in this film, like just hilarious lines that we tapped into when we were releasing the film. There was just no shortage of just kind of fun you could have with all of these quotes. Yeah. But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of that stems from these people being themselves, right? Mm. You know, I think like for him, he was able to channel who, you know, a version of who he was, who he is, or who he was. And, you know, like it wasn't masking the fact that he was an actor. You know, it's playing into that, right? I think if they were to assign him a role or a job and say, hey, you know, Michael, you're a, trucker, like it wouldn't be authentic. So, you know, it's coming into the space playing as who you are. You know, I think that again, like, really plays into the reality that's evident or that is constructed. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's almost like a mumblecore meets Altman sort of, you know, roster of you know, or mumblecore meets Altman sort of ensemble, I guess you could say, because just totally. Really, by the time you're done with the quote unquote hang of the film, it's like you feel like you've kind of met everybody and loved everybody by then. And yeah, I think like being able to start your day with Michael kind of at his lowest, and, you know, see kind of the high, you know, by the end of the film, despite this kind of somber element of the closing, you know, there's kind of like an energizing sort of quality to it. You know, by the end of the film, I think we're all questioning, like, you know, ideally, like, what's next for these people, and wanting what's best for them, really.
The bar gets started and the music starts and the drinks start coming. And as this final night at the Roaring Twenties, as we progress through the day, I felt more buoyant and more joyful with the characters. They were, and we'll get into a couple of the other characters. One of the characters that broke my heart, the veteran, the man, you know, he has this very beautiful conversation with this woman, also a veteran, about that this is the only place I can come. You know, this is the only, and though you feel so heartbroken for them, but so happy that they have this place. And so I found myself becoming so overjoyed for these people who I was fully believing, because I should, because they're real people. And they have this wonderful evening. And then it the denouement of this, I felt so crushed and heartbroken that this night was over. And the filmmakers themselves even said they, you know, I think they grew up in Vegas, or they spent a lot of time there. And they wanted to show a place where people could come together in the shadow of the lights of Vegas. And I think poetically and metaphorically, I get that sense here. This bar is the island of misfit toys. In a way, these people they're special, and they're special for finding each other, but you know they're not taken seriously by the world outside. And it makes me love them more in a way that they've been able to find each other. It was a much more emotional watch than I anticipated. And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with the Vegas angle, which, you know, I think Vegas, to me, is one of the loneliest cities I've ever been to.
Totally.
It's arguably, in my opinion, the most American city with the excess. There's no city where you can both be in Venice and Paris within 10 minutes, right?
And yet, and totally plastic versions of them.
Right. And how American is it to say we have both Venice and Paris and everything else? And, you know, it's a city where you can't even necessarily walk on the street because all of everything is connected through casinos. So, you know, it's only when you go into kind of like old Vegas, I guess, for lack of better words, do you find more of like these classic dive bars, like the tiki bars. Yeah, old Vegas is kind of cast aside to this new Vegas where, you know, now you have the Sphere, you know, and like, you know, like this like achievement of like modern music and entertainment. And, you know, that's what Vegas has become, is like the one-upmanship of we're just going to keep getting bigger and bigger. So, you know, I think the setting really adds to, you know, what kind of the core like idea they're getting to is, which is kind of like being miscast, being alone, you know, loss, America, you know, like, again, like I think this is kind of one of the most American films I've probably ever worked on. I'm pretty sure the brothers grew up mostly in New Orleans, but I think they spent a bunch of time in Vegas as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as you said earlier, you know, even though the bar and the whole shoot was New Orleans, like, you know, they still went to Vegas and, you know, all the exteriors are Vegas. So, you know, there's that level of authenticity, but you're not seeing the Vegas that we see on social media when you see clips of the Sphere or like Adele doing her, you know, like
Lady Gaga. You know,
yeah, you know, all of these massive stars who are doing their residencies. This is that outcast side of Vegas. And these people, or maybe most of them, do self-identify as outcasts. And, you know, maybe that is why they consciously or subconsciously gravitate to this bar or bars and excess of drinking as well.
No, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, I never thought of Vegas in that way, that it is the most American city, but in a way that makes total sense. It is commercial, it is loud, it is Cirque du Soleil, it is every cuisine you want, it's every city you want represented. You can win big, you can lose everything, you know, you can kind of have any drug, any kind of anything you want. And yet, if we look at that as America, there are the people, you know, if you're not the loudest, who are you? If you're not, you know, if you're not branded and commercialized and you know, if you're not an influencer or on a poster somewhere, who are you? Do you even exist? And it's this weird existential liminal space that I find the most interesting parts of America. And sadly, I feel like we don't see that a lot. I went to school in London, so I felt like I knew the outsider view of it, and much of that is correct, but much of that doesn't come close to, you know, the smell and the softness and the comfort and the quilt work of people and the real, I don't know, the real human beings that aren't loud enough to be on a poster. And I feel like this film really dives into those kinds of people, the people that honestly, other people might not think really exist in America.
Yeah. Well, I was mistaken as well when I said they mostly grew up in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
So Bill and Turner's first film is called 45365. And it's the zip code of the town they grew up in, which I want to say is Sydney, Ohio.
Really?
It's a really fascinating watch from Bloody Notes Empty Pockets because it's a much more kind of cinema verite, I guess you could say, feel, where it's all about real people. You're at the barbershop, you're with the local football team. You're experiencing, you know, this slice of life that you wouldn't normally see. I grew up in like the woods of New York. When I went to university in Texas, much different sort of culture, you know, and the only way we bridge the gap and understand other people is by meeting them and having conversations. That's also why this film to me is like really poignant, because you have this opportunity to have these conversations without having to have them yourself. And I think that's what the Ross brothers are so great at doing, is putting you into the world with people you might be too afraid to engage with yourself or too closed off to engage with yourself, you know, without getting like political. That's why we are in the state of the world that we are. And it's not just the US, it's everywhere. People don't want to have conversations. So, you know, how do we create opportunities to kind of spoon feed the conversations? It's like, I always think about like the like pill pockets for dogs. It's like you have to like sneak the pill in to like a little like treat to get them to eat it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like going to the University of Texas at Austin, when I went, it was like all of these mumblecore filmmakers that were the professors. You know, like I had a lot of friends as a New Yorker who went to NYU, and, you know people who go to USC, and it's like, you know, there's like, sure, at NYU, it's like you could learn from Spike Lee, one of my favorite directors, love him. But it's also much different than, you know, when you're learning from somebody who is trying to still figure out how to make movies for no budget. And, you know, I was always a big fan of mumblecore and, you know, in a way still am, because I think there always was a bit of an authenticity to those sort of films, like Brian Poyser, or like I always think about Lovers of Hate was a great film that was, I think, one of Alex Karpovsky's first kind of bigger roles, you know, or breakout roles. It's a film that basically just takes place in one home. So, you know, making movies, as you're aware, well aware, is so challenging. You know, how many locations do you have? How many actors do you have? What's the crew? You know, and I think what's achieved here is like, how do we condense everything into kind of one space and really make it achievable and bigger than just like we're only hanging out at a bar, you know? Because even though the film is so contained, to me, it feels much bigger.
That's so well said. And I think that's the skill of the directors, to create this structure where that can thrive and feel so vital and so alive. I think so many films now, especially studio films and blockbuster films, everyone's using a multiverse and everyone's trying to save the universe and the galaxy and multiple universes, and the bigger the stakes. And I'm just so exhausted by the universe constantly needing saving that honestly, I'm just like, I would love to just see human beings talking and like existing and communicating in a room.
The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up. March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.
Even in my notes, I'm looking here. Some of their names I did get, and some of them I didn't. One of the guys, one of the older men in the bar, I called Einstein because he has like big white hair. And he's a character. He talks about the smell of kudzu, which is so interesting because that only grows in the Southeast and in America. And I was like, oh, that's not a Vegas thing. But it didn't matter. Like, who cares? There's Ira, who is just so drunk before noon. And I guess all of these people are actually drinking, right? I assume. Like,
yeah.
Otherwise,
yeah.
That's the best drunk acting I've ever seen.
No, they're all there. They're drinking. They're celebrating. It's, you know, the prompt was you're showing up to a bar and it's your final chance to celebrate with your friends. And
yeah,
you know, I think some of those performances aren't performances in the sense that it's no one pretending to be drunk. If they're drunk on screen, it's because they have indeed been drinking, you know? And I think,
yeah,
I mean, like I was seeing some of the press around one battle after another. You know, Leo's a great actor. But, you know, somebody approached him. It was like a quick little viral video. And they're like, how'd you prepare to play a stoner? Like, you must have like been getting stoned before it. And he was like, no, I can't do that. Like, I can't act stoned. And I've heard that from a lot of actors, actually. But, you know, who find they can't get to kind of that place of authenticity. They say that they're trying to reach when they're acting under the influence of something. It's because it's kind of a different world, right? I mean, you are playing make-believe, you're constructing something, your performance is being edited into little bits in a good way. I'm not saying that's negative, but you know, you need to be like quite aware when you're acting, because are you going to hit your mark? Is it, you know, maybe it's dangerous on the set. Maybe there's stunts. Like, you know, if you're showing up to a massive action movie and you're stoned out of your mind, like it's not safe. It's literally not safe. So, you know, there's different mechanics to how all these things work. And I think, you know, that also like leads into the beauty of what Bill and Turner have created here, which is a very safe space.
But here, it gives these real people the permission to just be themselves. And I'm sure it lubricated literally their abilities to kind of forget the camera was even there and to just really engage and be themselves. And we get into these really beautiful conversations. Roy Orbison's Crying starts playing, and we see the female bartender stealing herself to come in for her shift. Her son, who has been stealing liquor from the bar to get drunk with his friends out back, he's there. And he's like, no, I'm not going to steal. And so we meet more of these characters. But I just have to focus in on, the two veterans that I had mentioned before, this older black man and this 60-year-old white woman who does show her boobs later on, and she's very proud of them. And they are blurred, but she should be proud of those, I think. They had such a beautiful conversation and real tears. And this part, I feel like getting choked up even talking about it, the idea of feeling forgotten by the world outside. This conversation, there's nothing false about this conversation. It just rings so true and so heartbreaking, because you can see these people who do feel they've served time in the military and they feel forgotten, and your heart just goes out to these characters. I just, that's one moment in this film that I just had to kind of, I actually had to pause it because I was just so sad for them.
Yeah.
And so happy that they had a moment together and that they had each other in this moment, because
it's definitely one of the kind of, most emotional beats in the film. There's also another moment. I think it's the same woman with the guy you described as Einstein, where they're talking about losing family. You know, he had lost his wife. She had lost her son. Yeah, I mean, you know, like going back to the veteran moment, it's something we've seen addressed in pop culture and, you know, war films, like maybe like a Jarhead sort of movie where it's like, oh, you know, the veteran returns home and, you know, who cares now that they're not, you know, serving the country, or, you know, maybe they get, you know, somebody tips their hat to them here and there. Yeah, they're kind of, you know, maybe they're searching for purpose after living through something incredibly traumatic. You know, I mean, I'm not a veteran, you know, like I can't speak to that at a personal level, but yeah, I mean, it's something we've been familiar with this idea of before. It's like, what do these people do when they come back home? Like, you know, not everybody aspires to work the same job their entire lives, whether that's a teacher, a soldier, a dance instructor, whatever it is, right? My hope is that, you know, I tend to always think like we can, there's a kind of like cliched saying of like, we contain multitudes. So, you know, who are you when you're not a soldier? Who are you when you're not a filmmaker, a film distributor, whatever it is, right? Do people see you for who you are? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's kind of the root of it, is these people are seen. It's kind of scary sometimes to be seen, right? Like, I feel like we try to hide that sometimes as a generalization. Not everybody wants to be seen.
Yeah.
Which, funny enough, sort of like roots into, you know, this film in a way roots into a few creative projects my partner Anna and I have taken on consciously and subconsciously. You know, one of our first short films, or our first short film that we made together, is called Hi, You Are Currently Being Recorded, which is about Anna visiting her then boyfriend in Los Angeles, who you don't see. And she goes on a walk, smoking some weed, and soon discovers that all of these houses in this nice LA neighborhood are recording her, and goes for a speaking to her, Hi, You Are Currently Being Recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of that short film came about because the two of us went on a walk in this neighborhood looking for a hiking trail, walking around on the weekend, smoking a joint, thinking, oh, we'll find a trail that passes through somebody's backyard into one of these like big, you know, parks in the area. And we found ourselves accosted by not one, but about a handful, 5-6+ Ring cameras that literally do speak to you and say, hi, you are currently being recorded. Basically, the next day we were like, we should just, that would be a fun exercise. Why don't we make that into a short film? For us, it was this experiment of like channeling what was real while also working within the fiction of filmmaking, I guess. So we reconstructed the exact same walk that we took. Like, every camera that you see in the film speaking to Anna was based off, was literally in the same position that we found these cameras. Yeah, it was all rooted in this idea of perception, who's watching and who's being watched, and how scary it can be in a way to sometimes be perceived. You know, we're making that, Bloody Nose wasn't a thematic reference, but in a way it was, I guess you could say, spiritual reference, which was, how do we try to create something that is rooted in our real life experience and blurs those lines between fact and fiction? And then since then, the two follow-up projects we've worked on together, because Anna has her own creative practice, are also rooted in, I guess, what you could call documentary, but then similarly would be challenged by some individuals who are, I guess, afraid of changing the documentary status quo, for lack of better words. And, you know, I think that's kind of what happened with Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. You know, so the second short film we made features me playing a film distributor opposite Anna's cousin, who's a real life independent filmmaker. And the whole premise of that short is a film distributor and this indie filmmaker are meeting up to practice French secretly before they go off to Cannes. It, you know, kind of exposes the haves and the have-nots, or the artistry versus industry of the film business as we saw it and see it, which is, you know, his character is showing up to this festival and needs a place to stay. On the opposite side of the table is somebody who's working in the industry on a different side and has a hotel room paid for by a company, you know, comedy ensues essentially. But that conversation was rooted in a real life conversation we had when Aaron's film premiered in Rotterdam a year plus ago, where we were sitting at a bar having some drinks and started speaking really stupidly in French. So yeah, I think like for me at a creative level, you know, Bloody Nose like really is one of the most inspirational films I've seen in probably the last decade. I feel like we need to keep pushing documentary forward and filmmaking forward and striving to not just say, okay, this is how everything is made just because everybody else does this one thing. You know, there's so many great mockumentaries that doc hybrids, as now people call it, that I really admired growing up. Like, you know, a very classic example would be F is for Fake by Orson Welles. That's a really well-known one. Mm. Man Bites Dog.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, obviously you have like the more commercial ones, like a Spinal Tap. So I've always found myself drawn to what are these films that are bridging, you know, the documentary and fiction. And it's something we've definitely explored a good amount at Utopia. There's another fantastic film on our slate called Crustone by Marnie Ellen, which is about a group of SoundCloud rappers who move to the desert of Colorado to grow weed and make music. And that's the very simple premise of the film. But within those constraints, you also have to then question again, like, what is real, what isn't? We worked on a movie called El Planeta by Amalia Ullman, which was rooted in her own personal experiences and her mom's life, really. And that was a film that was similar to Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, was acknowledged at the Cinema Eye Honors, which is, you know, kind of like one of the main awards for documentary these days. And if you were to look at El Planeta on paper, or if you look at the trailer, you would say that's crazy. That's clearly a fictional film. But, you know, obviously at the end of the day, we're classifying movies and anything. We try and put a genre on them to try and package them to make them more understandable to audiences. But, you know, I think like trying to push outside of these lines and like generic classifications can be, to me, very exciting.
It reminds me of, you know, I'm not a documentary filmmaker, but what you're saying here reminds me of Sarah Polley's documentary Stories We Tell, partially because it starts out as a very traditional doc in her own life about her family. And in the midst of filming this, she discovers something and it changes. And that is a very personal documentary. But at the core of it, looking at this film, it is constructed. Anyone making a doc is constructing the narrative. There is no truth. You know, there is no, there is reality. I mean, you can go into the psychoanalysis, the Lacanian theories of like, what is the real? But everyone tells a story differently, even if they're telling the same story. And so the author of that story, whether you're calling it doc or something else, it is going to be different. And this is a really, it's quite telling that people get so defensive when talking about this kind of genre, because I can see and hear so many people crossing their arms and being like, well, that's not doc. And I guess it's similar to, it reminds me too, my second point, this film kind of reminds me of what Andy Warhol did a bit in looking at his friends and documenting and narrativizing his real life and people he knew that were larger than life. And I think I quite like Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets more than a lot of the works of Andy Warhol, just because I do think there's a bit more humanity at the heart of this film. But problematic or not, like any of this or not, it is affecting. At the end of this watch, not to blow up a spot, but my husband was just like, I don't know how I feel about that. And I was like, I don't either, honestly, because, and just to segue into the talking about the end of the film, Michael, our main character, as you said, the actor playing himself, is wasted and sleeping on the couch. And my God, the scene between him and the younger man who's in the bar getting wasted, Michael grabs him, and this younger guy is like on top of him, and it's very intimate. Like, he's holding his collar, pulling this young man towards him, and he's like, look at me. You have to leave. You have to leave. And you know, both of these men are so drunk that none of this is fake. And I felt like I shouldn't even be watching this, but it was such an intimate conversation. The kind of conversation I feel like I've had when I was younger and wasted in a bar and just having a deep heart to heart and crying with somebody but the moment was just so real. And it's this older man telling this younger man to get out while you still can. It just felt so iconic and archetypal in the Joseph Campbell kind of way of like, this is the older generation counseling the younger generation to do something different. It's because this film seems to operate on a level that's greater than reality. It's different. It's beside it. It's going parallel with it. That moment just really affected me. And then at the end, the bar has to close and Michael is told to go and to drive safely. And he turns and says, "You don't know me at all." Because one assumes he doesn't drive. He gets all of these bags and he wanders away and we don't know where he goes. And I felt so devastated at the end of this film, Kyle. Like, it's really sat with me. I actually didn't sleep well after watching this film because I worried about Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I like to hope in a very optimistic sense that they all found the next bar, right?
Because, I like that.
Because, you know, it just seems like that would be the inevitable thing for each one of them. Perhaps not all of them ended up at the same place, but that's kind of how life goes, right? We take our paths, one path ends, another one begins or branches off. But yeah, I think it's a really, like, "You don't know me at all" is such like a strong way of, you know, it's just that line. Yeah, I mean, it's so resonant in a way because it's like any setting we find ourselves in. You go to work, you have your relationship with your coworkers. You go to the bar, they know you in a very specific way. When kids are growing up and like leaving high school and going to university, you know, you see so many instances of like, maybe this person was a goth in high school and then they go to college and they become an entirely different person. So, you know, like, we have all these opportunities to recreate ourselves or to position ourselves in different ways in different spaces. I don't necessarily feel like positioning oneself in many different ways in different spaces is a healthy way to live. But the aspect of people are only ever going to see what they want to see as well. And they'll only know as much as you tell them. If the bartender only ever sees you inside the bar, how the hell are they going to know whether or not you drive or not, unless that's a topic of conversation? So yeah, I think the relationships, kind of many relationships, operate on a surface level. Like, how, and that goes back to this idea of like being seen, right? Because how much are we letting ourselves be seen? And I think like through the end of this night, so much does come out that maybe wasn't said between these individuals during the last year, 2 years, however many years they had been going to this bar and hanging out. And sometimes it takes these big moments in our lives to push us into having these kind of realizations, conversations, however you want to put it, to allow oneself to be seen. So yeah, I think, you know, again, I hope in the movie world of Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, each one of them went on to find their next bar and their next community. But as they went on to their next spaces, they probably took with them a new veneer, I guess you could say, or put on a new veneer, a new facade rather, that needed to kind of be chipped away over time. So yeah, I mean, I guess, like, again, in that way, there's this universal element, which is, you know, when I go to work, am I talking to my coworkers about my weekend, or am I just saying, in an authentic way? Or am I just saying, oh, how was your weekend? I had a good weekend, you know? Or are you saying really what you did or hope to do? So I think there's that element kind of within it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, there's also just such like a prescient kind of aspect of this movie with some of the lines that are said, which are rooted in real life feelings, like the veteran who comments on the political spectrum. There's the lines you've talked about from Michael, but then there's the idea of just the bar closing, you know, like this movie came out. Now that we're going full circle near the end, I think my recollection is, as I corrected myself, that it did premiere at Sundance before COVID hit. And then COVID hit, bars started closing everywhere because they couldn't stay open.
And
it's like, what are these spaces that are so essential that we don't really think about? Like when I was younger and in Brooklyn, like I remember all of these like DIY music spaces that got booted out by like Vice coming in. So it was like all the culture and like history just got taken over by a corporation. You know, like what ends up taking over the Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets bar? Like what becomes of the shopping center where the Roaring Twenties was? Does a Walmart go up? Does Vegas continue to expand? You know, the next sphere sort of structure is built there.
I
think the film has lived such an interesting life despite its challenges of coming out during COVID, because it almost perfectly fit the moments that years that followed. And like you asked me also, like at the beginning of the conversation, why it, what attracted us, me and our team to the film, which was that shared experience of like, we are all kind of isolated now. We're seeing things close. And how do we deal with that, really?
Well, and it speaks too in and just in wrapping up the conversation, this feels metaphorical of the film industry itself, because independent filmmaking and the work you guys are doing at Utopia and your company Circle Collective, the independent space of cinema is where the exciting things are happening, I think. And that's, you know, of course, I'm going to think that because that's the kind of films I make and the films I watch are typically independent in the midst of big blockbuster, massive acquisition, commercial blockbuster, like just money, 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 box office numbers. And I do watch those films, sure, but I don't know where I fit in. I feel like that's the really loud, fancy bar on the strip that I'm like, I don't know. I don't feel like I fit in there. Like, I do kind of want to live in the indie bar around those kind of people and see what the people who are doing exciting work that might not be run by a studio, these exercises in creativity, this experiment, this kind of filmmaking, this is the exciting part of it. And I'm just so grateful for the work you're doing to kind of curate these films and bring more attention to them, because they are unlike anything else that I'm seeing in the commercial space. And I think more people should be watching films like this. I think it's a really beautiful snapshot and a very personal snapshot of America and, you know, the people that might not be the loudest or the prettiest or the coolest or the strongest superheroes on the block. I love this island of misfits. So thank you so much for bringing this film to my attention. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm so truly thrilled that you enjoyed it and, yeah, reacted so strongly to it. I mean, it's just, yeah, it was such a great opportunity for me to revisit it now, like four or so years later, and remember exactly why I loved it so much. And my like main takeaway from this conversation, which is something I think about a lot, but also kind of a reinvigorating reminder, is like what the Ross brothers seemingly kind of remind everyone in the industry regularly is stop trying to fit in. Stop trying to just purely be seen and try to see yourself. That's what makes their filmmaking so unique. And I think what has made, I don't want to say me and Utopia, I don't want to necessarily say successful, but what has worked for Utopia and myself when we're releasing independent films is I tend to put on kind of horse blinders and I focus on what I'm doing. I don't look at what other people are doing because it's just not relevant. It's just all conversation. And that conversation in trade magazines doesn't reflect real people. That's, again, what, you know, is so special here is it's the real people. Yeah, really appreciate your time and openness to checking this one out.
No, thank you so much. I love this addition to a growing collection of Tower films. I love how different each film has been, and I love that you chose this one for your episode. So, Kyle, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed chatting as always. And yeah, talk to you soon.
The Tower is a Glass Eye Picks production. The show is created and hosted by me, Emily Bennett. The show is produced by Jordan Goss-Poure. Technical advisor is Justin Brooks. Sound engineering by Michael McFadden. Original music for The Tower was composed by Graham Resnick. Additional music provided by Epidemic Sound. Art by Snake Mountain. See you next time.
The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.